Today's program is brought to you by 100 Bogart Street, a co-working and event space in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Learn more at 100bogart.com.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
I always talk to my cooks and I say, you know, your cooking's your undergrad. And
yeah.
Your line cook, it's your undergrad. You get a little bit of money. It's a little bit more broad. It's a little bit more out there.
Right.
I go, and it might be for 4 years and it might be for 7 years. It depends on the kind of person you are. You know, I go, and then you make a sous chef. And I go, that's your master's. You get a little bit more focused in. Figure out what you want to do. You get a little bit more skills that are more high end. You know, you're learning more butchery, pasta making, whatever it is. And then, you know, eventually you're going to be chef de cuisine somewhere. And I go, now you're a PhD candidate. You're just working on your thesis. And your thesis is going to be your restaurant. So, you know, what is the research you need to do to complete that? And that's, you know, the way I like to look at it. I'm like, I think if you look at it in terms of education, it's a little bit easier to explain our career to people who might not get it.
That is Chef Joe Flam of Spiaggia Restaurant in Chicago, Illinois, our guest this week on Andrew Talks to Chefs. It's gonna take a Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I'm your host, Andrew Friedman, here with my wife and introductory co-host, Caitlin Friedman. And Caitlin.
Yes, Andrew.
Can I tell you something?
Yes.
I think you might be a songwriter.
Okay, stop.
Those who have seen it or seen the ubiquitous trailer know that that's from A Star is Born. And our guest this week is Bradley Cooper. No, it's not.
Aww.
I'm sorry. You liked it way more than I did.
I did like it. I thought it, I don't know. I actually did really like it. Made me very sad in a good way.
Okay. Our guest this week is Joe Flam, executive chef of Spiaggia Restaurant in Chicago, and also a Top Chef champion. We're going to introduce him in a second, but first, we have some things we need to talk about. The Red Cat Restaurant. Caitlin.
Yes.
The Red Cat Restaurant, it was just announced the other day, is going to be closing at the end of this year. The Red Cat is the restaurant of Chef Jimmy Bradley. He opened it in partnership with another friend of ours, Danny Abrams. Jimmy's been the sole proprietor for years now. It is a real important restaurant to us. And also, people who have been following me on Heritage Radio Network know that I did a show up until not that long ago, before this show, called The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew, and the Jimmy in that was Jimmy Bradley. I co-authored Jimmy's Red Cat cookbook. And more than any of that, he's just been a good friend of ours since the restaurant opened, which, do you know the year? I don't know if you do.
I have no idea.
1999.
Here's the incredible thing about that restaurant. It's, for me, it has professional memories. It has personal memories. We've spent Thanksgiving celebrations there. I've launched clients there. I mean, just the sheer amount of special moments that we've had at that restaurant is pretty incredible.
Yeah. The Red Cat, for people listening, first of all, I want to stress this. It will be open till the end of the year. So if you live in New York City, or if you're visiting New York City, you should go and experience the Red Cat one or more final times. It is a restaurant. This is now a common thing that people say about restaurants. They'll say it's a neighborhood restaurant that's also a destination restaurant. The Red Cat sort of created that category, or was among a handful of places here that did. And it's just a very special place. I want to send my love out to Jimmy and the whole crew there. And I think that's all we'll say about it here. Although I will say, I'm trying desperately to get back to blogging on my Topland blog. And I have a peace in mind about what it means when restaurants close. I think the emotions that go into restaurant closings is fascinating. Because there's plenty of other restaurants. There may be a restaurant that emerges in the same space as the restaurant that's closing. The person closing the restaurant is not deceased, you know,
right.
But it is so powerful when a restaurant closes. I think it's a fascinating subject. So I have some thoughts about that I'm trying to funnel into a piece that, well, if I run it or get it done, I will link to it on my Instagram feed. And Caitlin, before we go any further, I need to give a shout out to the crew of Blackbird Restaurant in Chicago. That is one of Paul Kahan's restaurants. One of the cooks from that restaurant was at the talk I gave last week at Read It and Eat Bookstore in Chicago. And I am told, he said this to the whole room, that the entire, or I guess most of, I don't know if it's everybody, crew at that restaurant are listening to this show. This cook who was in the audience said that he discovered the show because the cooks there listen to the show every week and trade notes on the chefs and all that. And you're making a little sentimental face as I say this.
Well, it's nice.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I think it's great.
It made me feel so freaking good. Yeah. So, and to the cook who was in the audience, I'm deliberately not naming you. I don't know if you would want me to do that, but you know how to find me if you want to complain about that. Also, this Saturday, I'm going to be in Las Vegas. There is a collaborative chef dinner being put on at the Luxor Hotel. Very fancy. Everyone who buys a ticket will get a copy of my book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, signed, and I will be happy to personalize it. The most important thing about the dinner, though, is not me or my book, but the chefs who are cooking. It is going to be prepared by five legends who are all still practicing. They are happen to be featured in my book. Mary Sue Milliken, Nancy Silverton, Stephen Piles, Jimmy Schmidt, and Jeremiah Tower. How about that?
That's impressive.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I'm told the book in some ways occasioned the dinner. That's hard for me to fathom, but it's amazing. I'll be saying a few words. I believe there are still tickets available, and you can go to my website, tokeland.com/appearances, and you will see a listing of that and other events, and each of those listings has a link to which you can buy tickets for the particular event. So that's what's going on. Now, Joe Flam. Joe Flam is the executive chef of Spiaggia Restaurant in Chicago. He is Chicago born and bred. He has been in Chicago his whole life. He's from the south side of the city. All of his jobs were in Chicago restaurants. He's become sort of a protege of Tony Montuano, who was on this show not that long ago, back in the spring. And interestingly, I think, Tony is one of the rare chefs who will actually give a chef working under him the title of executive chef. Do you know what the difference between that and chef de cuisine is?
Well, as co-host of the show, I'd like to say I do know the difference, but I don't know the difference.
This is why you're the perfect co-host.
Yeah.
You should ask me.
Andrew, what's the difference?
The difference, Caitlin, is chef de cuisine usually implies that the executive chef or chef owner is exerting a certain amount of control over you, that they have a larger role in the whole process, right? And executive chef is really saying this person kind of runs the kitchen, you know? And Tony's very much a part of Spiaggia still. He's there all the time. He was there every time I popped in there when I was in Chicago last week. But that is a real nod and a real sign of respect and belief in the people who work for you. And I think that says a lot. And but this interview is really mostly about, obviously, Joe and his story. I think it's a very interesting one. And I don't think I need to say a whole lot more about it. But we, you know, the first time I met Joe was last week on a night when they did a dinner for me in Chicago. And I will be totally honest, the dinner was at my request. I was going there for some book PR. I had an open night. I asked Tony if Spiaggia might do a promotional dinner for the book. They did an 80s-style menu, which was a lot of fun. Joe does a pasta, which he calls 1985 pasta. The main course was a Dover sole, and Tony came around the room and shaved white truffle over it. The wines by the sommelier there, Rachel Lowe, were tremendous. And but Joe, even though my relationship was with Tony, was the one who was kind of saddled with creating this menu. And boy, did he step up. And I really appreciate it. And I want to say that publicly. Joe Flam, thank you very much. And I think that's it, Caitlin.
All right.
So here we go. My interview with Chef Joe Flam, recorded last week at Spiaggia Restaurant in Chicago, Illinois. Here you go. Okay, so you and I literally just met for the first time last night.
Correct.
You did this amazing dinner. How often do you guys even do something like that? Like a one-time only menu?
You know, me and Tony, we like doing a lot of those kind of, just because I think it's always fun when you're just, you know, we have a lot of just like silly ass ideas. Like, you know, I'm like, hey, what if we did this? And he's, you know, the thing I love about Tony, for a guy who's been doing it for so long, he's open to anything. And I just will pitch him with the craziest shit. And he'll be like, yeah, okay. Like,
yeah.
If you want to do that, it's like, cool. Like, it sounds like fun.
You know,
if it sounds like fun, he'll do it, basically.
I was, well, not, to me, not just, I don't know, it's weird. I feel a natural kinship with him, even though we haven't spent a lot of time together. But when he did this show earlier this year, he was, I mean, he was so current on, like, new style wines.
Mm-hmm.
He was current on what's going on in restaurants. And as you said, for someone who's been at it that long, he seems incredibly, open-minded.
Yeah, I mean,
which was it shouldn't be unusual, because I think that's the key to lasting in your business.
And you know, I think Tony's genuine is, I think, one of the, you know, best ways I've ever heard him described is, I was talking to Jonathan Waxman about Tony one time, and you know, of course, and Waxman was like, you know, he's just so genuine.
Yeah.
He's just a guy who's comfortable in his own skin.
Very much so.
And he's like, and a guy of his generation, and a chef of his generation, he's like, man, that is not true for a lot of us.
Right.
And he's like, but he is.
Yeah.
And, you know, Tony's genuinely excited for, like, young chefs coming up and new stuff that's happening. And me and him talk about that all the time, whether it's in Chicago, New York, San Fran. We're always talking about restaurants, you know, always talking about wine. Whenever each one of us comes back from travel, the first thing we do is we sit down for an hour, usually.
Sometimes it's a debrief, three hours.
And, you know, just talk about, like, he just got back from Italy. So just, oh, we got to talk about Italy. And I was in Croatia before that, and we talk about Croatia. Or even it's just, like, I was in Connecticut for 24 hours.
Right.
And he's like, so what'd you eat in Connecticut? What's going on in Connecticut? You know, and it's like,
interesting.
You know, it's Hartford. There's not a ton going on, but.
Right. Why'd you go to Croatia?
My wife's Croatian.
Okay.
And
first generation American, or was she born over there?
Her dad was born over there.
Okay.
Her dad speaks Croatian, is Croatian, but he was born at a time when Croatia wasn't Croatia, so he was born in a refugee camp in Austria.
Wow.
So I think they classified it as like a person of the world, I think is, or yeah. citizen of
citizen
the world.
Of the world.
Yeah, that's what it is, citizen of the world, which we didn't know till we got married, and you know, you have to do all the back paperwork.
Yeah.
And so he's actually never been back, but her and I have talked about going forever, and we're having a baby in about 2 months.
Yes.
So this was kind of our baby moon, last big trip, and we just, you know, we're like, if we don't know, go now, when are we going to go?
Yeah.
And so we just, you know, went. We did about 8 days there, drove around.
What was it like?
It's incredible. You know, I think to me, the really interesting thing about Croatia is it's ungodly beautiful. I mean, the coast is unreal. It's so gorgeous. I think the food's really good. I think when you compare it to Italy, you got to work a little harder to find the great food there, but it's there, and it's incredible, and it's, you know, driven in history. And there's a ton of Italian influence there.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a lot of tourists there, but it's still a place that's so, in my mind, what I think of as untouched, because it's like, you know, you're in downtown Dubrovnik in the city walls, and then all of a sudden you can walk through like a cut doorway in the walls, and you go out onto the rocks that are just the rocks on the other side of the wall, and there's a bar on the rocks where it's just like people are just swimming and drinking and jumping off the rocks into the ocean. It's like, there's nowhere else I would let you do this. And as much as people are like, oh, it's so touristy, it's like, you know, nobody's let you having a drink even sitting on a rock in Disney.
Right.
Like, you're anywhere in the States.
Yeah.
And it's, it was just, I thought those parts of it were incredible. I thought the people were insanely nice.
What's the language issue like? Do a lot of people speak English there? Or is it easy to get around not speaking the language?
I was shocked. I felt like everybody spoke English.
Really?
Like, we were trying to pick up Croatian phrases before we left, and it's like, you know, I mean, I was in a gas station an hour outside of Dubrovnik, headed up to Split, and it was like they spoke better English than, you know, gas stations of, you know, most of the cities are the U.S.
Wow.
Like, it was like, this guy speaks better English than I do.
Yeah.
Like, what is happening?
Yeah.
I was really surprised by that.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, well, let's talk about your story. If you don't mind, there's a detail of your life that I'm fascinated by.
Okay.
Your mom was a cop.
Yeah, my mom's a lieutenant in Chicago.
Still on the force?
Still active duty.
Okay, now when you grew up, is this right? She worked the 5 p.m. to 2 a.m. shift?
She was. She worked second shift a long time, which is usually like 5 to 2, 5 p.m. to 2. And then when we got a little bit older, she switched to midnights, and she was on midnights for maybe 20 years. So you work, you know, 11 to around 11 or midnight, you start, and you're there till, you know, 6, 7, 8 in the morning.
Yeah.
So a lot of days it's just we'd be getting ready for school, and she'd be coming home from work.
Wow.
And that was kind of our paths crossed. And then when I was in culinary school, there'd be a lot of days where I'd be coming home from going out, and she'd be coming home from work. She was less thrilled about.
Right.
But what was that like? That's an unusual. It's not super unusual, mm-hmm. but it's not. I mean, I don't think I've known anyone who's. I've known a lot of people whose dads were cops. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've known anyone whose mom was a cop. And what was it like having a mom who was like in that line of work at those hours?
You know.
How did it shape your worldview? I guess that's what I'm looking for.
You know, I think an interesting part of it is, like, you know, you have to understand my mom's family. My mom's one of nine, and she has six sisters. And they were all, you know, two of them are lawyers, one's an architect, two are dietitians, one's an engineer. Like, they're all professionals. They're all, you know, and my grandfather, for all his craziness, was just like, you know, you couldn't tell anyone in his family they couldn't do whatever they wanted. And, you know, I remember, you know, the famous story in our family is when my mom went to my grandpa and said, "Hey, I'm going to become a cop." And he said, "Why do you want to become a cop? Any asshole can be a cop." And she was like, you know, this is what I wanted to do. She was a social worker before that. Okay. And I think for her, she looked at it as a way of this is me being a social worker, but more impactful and being able to get my hands a little bit more into it and see what's going on. And so, you know, but for me, it wasn't that crazy. Like, the neighborhood I grew up in on the south side of Chicago, it was like there was a ton of cops. There was a ton of firemen, or you were in a union, or you were in a mm-hmm. trade. Like, it wasn't like crazy that my mom was a cop. I knew other women who were cops. I knew, you know, that was just what it was.
So that was the world you were born into, and it seemed normal.
Right. You know, it's like there was a school function, and half your parents had guns at it, you know, and that was mm-hmm. just kind of like the south side of Chicago.
Right.
Like, it is what it is. Like, you know, right. we all have like crazy stories.
I wish
stories.
People could see the physical mustard you put on that sentence.
You know, and
there's a lot of attitude in that delivery. Yeah.
And so, like, that was never, it was never crazy to me that my mom was a cop. That's just who she was. That's what she was. You know what I mean? That's how she acted. And, you know, my mom, I'm 6'3", and I'm a big guy. My mom's 5'2". She's, you know, just a little spitfire. You know, and I just, it was crazy how she was able to climb her way through the ranks, you know, becoming a sergeant. When she became a sergeant, she went to law school. So she has a law degree.
But with no intention of practicing?
Just
she wanted to understand the law?
She wanted to understand the law a little bit more, and I think it was always kind of her retirement plan. And,
I love it.
You know, that she's never been able to really walk away from it. And then she went from lieutenant from sergeant and became a lieutenant. And I think she's been a lieutenant for almost 10 years now, which is incredible, you know. And she's worked all over the city. She's worked in the craziest places. Back when, you know, we had the projects in Chicago, she was a sergeant in 2, which was at the time the worst district in the United States. She was working midnights there. Yeah. Like, but that was just like, that's what she did. The same as, like, you know, people go to me like, "Oh, you're a cook, you're a chef. That's such a crazy career." It's like, talk to those guys.
Right. Right. Were you worried about her as a kid?
No.
I mean, you say it was like normal to have people in the neighborhood who did that for a living, but like, what's your mom?
Yeah, you know, but it was normal. You know, a guy down the street from me got, you know, he was a cop who got shot on a drug raid a bunch of times, and, you know, he lived, and he was, you know, he's still alive. But it was like, that wasn't like crazy. That Even wasn't that. Like everybody was like, "Oh my God!" Like, it rocked the community. It was just like, "Oh yeah, Steve," you know, kicked in the door first and caught a couple.
Right.
Like, it was like, you know, like, that was just what it was.
Yeah.
So it wasn't weird to me. People are always like, "Oh wow, that's so crazy."
I hope
I'm
being clear. I don't think it was weird. I think it's fascinating.
I don't think it's weird.
It's very interesting.
But people always think it's really interesting.
Yeah.
And you know, and it's just kind of one of those things. I think when you just grow up with it, you know, you're just like, okay, this is my normal.
Yeah. So. You start cooking when? Like, as a kid.
What was the first little spark
for you?
You know, I grew up in a family that cooked. My grandmother cooked. My mom cooks. And we still to this day, every year on Thanksgiving, we have turkey, but we also have ravioli. So
what kind of ravioli?
We do two kinds. So there's like a ricotta and spinach one, mm-hmm. and then there's like a beef pork mixture with Parmigiano and like a breadcrumb. Just both simple red sauce.
Do you still do a stuffing or no?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Okay.
It's, so you, I mean, it's full,
a full-on traditional Thanksgiving dinner.
Thanksgiving plus ravioli plus meatballs.
Wow. And does this get coursed out?
No. So it's my family, you know, like I said, this is a large family. So this is 9 kids who almost all of them had at least 2 kids. So I'm one of 24 grandchildren.
Oh, my God. And most people are still in this area.
Everybody's kind of spread out some, but like growing up, you know, 7 of 9 of my mom's siblings all had kids in or around the south side of Chicago or the south suburbs or the southwest suburbs. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, we all kind of grew up together. But everyone comes back for, like, you know, every other year is the big Thanksgiving and everybody comes back. We still go to my grandmother's house, same for Christmas Eve. And those were really the traditions I started cooking. And I think part of it that, you know, I loved it was I love these traditions. I love these family. I'm so tight with my cousins. They're some of my best friends. So it's like I always looked forward to Thanksgiving because it was like we're going to eat really good food. I got to see my friends, you know, and we'd hang out and we're just running wild, playing in the snow, playing football. And the same thing with Christmas Eve is Christmas Eve was always a huge, you know, to do in my...
Did you do the 7 fishes?
Yeah, we'd done the Feast of the 7 fishes. You know, I remember being a little kid, and me and my grandma would go get the squid from the east side, because you had to buy it from the same guy that her mom bought it from.
Right.
And, you know, sitting at the table in the mudroom, just, you know, with a knife scraping out the insides of the squids with her when I, you know, I must have been 7, 8 years old. But, you know, and that was just more because nobody else wanted to do it, and I've just never found anything to be that gross. So I was like, yeah, I'll do it.
Right.
And I really just started to really, really enjoy the process of it. I always liked the idea. You know, one of my uncles told me, he goes, you know, if you want to eat well, learn how to cook, because then you can eat whatever you want. Mm-hmm. And it was like that just resonated with me. I was like, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wanted to be able to eat well, so I wanted to know how to make things.
Mm-hmm. So how did you start pursuing that?
You know, I think my first like catalyst for it, when my mom was working, when she was working second shift, she'd work 5 to 2. Yeah. It'd be a lot of times we get home from school and she'd be there, and then there'd be like, you know, an hour or two we're waiting for my dad to get home.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times she'd like leave us dinner to like heat up or to finish or whatever. And I have a sister who's 2 years older than me.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a terrible, terrible cook. And so she just didn't
care. Do I have to edit that out? Is that going to get
you in
trouble?
No, she knows.
Okay, this is...
She knows.
There's no illusions.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. We still talk about it to this day. When I was on Top Chef, I won Blue Apron for a year, and so I sent it to her. And so we have, like, this ongoing text of, like, her trying to make Blue Apron meals, and it's, like, it's so
fantastic.
She
can't do that?
Sometimes. But it's like, you know, the first one I sent her, she was like, oh, I screwed this up. And I was like, how? She's like, well, they're telling me to season something to taste. I was like, yeah, how'd you screw that up? She goes, well, how the fuck am I supposed to know what it tastes like?
Right,
I was like,
right.
Just season it till it tastes good. She's like, I don't know what fucking tastes good. I hate this. Like, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But that's, you know, her relationship with it. So I started taking over a little bit more of the cooking duties.
Yeah.
And I really, you know, I really enjoyed it. I started doing that. And then when I was in high school, I started working at restaurants at a pretty young age. I started working in restaurants when I was 15.
Mm-hmm.
And I really, I just...
Washing dishes or actually prepping?
I was, I started as a busboy.
Yeah.
And then I kind of just became, you know, I was working for my best friend's dad. And I was just kind of the guy he called when he needed anything. He'd be like, hey, you know, like, but TV broke. Can you go to Best Buy tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. when they open and make sure we have a TV? Like, go get the TV,
mm-hmm.
go get this, deliver this, whatever. And I just loved the restaurant. I loved being there. I loved the camaraderie of it. I loved the idea. It felt like family. It felt, mm-hmm. you know, it was a place where, you know, I think high school, everything feels so uncomfortable, right? And, you know, you're so looking for, like, something that feels good and it feels like a fit. And, you know, for me, it was like, you know, I never found anything like that until I really found restaurants. And I was like, this makes sense to me.
It felt like right away.
Yeah, it felt good. You know what I mean? It was like, mm-hmm. I just got to work hard and people like that. And
right.
then, you know, the harder you work, the more people liked you. And it's like, I worked good in that capacity of like, oh, I worked my ass off.
Were you industrious as a kid? Like, did you, I don't know what you would have. Did you have like a paper route or did you do stuff in the neighborhood or did you do stuff at home?
Yeah, you know, we were always, you know, had something going to try to make money, whether we were, you know, mowing lawns, shoveling snow,
you did that
raking
kind of stuff.
Leaves. Yeah, whatever it was, you know, try to get some cash.
Physical, you like physical work?
Yeah, and it was, you know.
Perfect.
And I just, I really fell in love with it in the restaurant. And right. that, you know, at that time in my life, I thought it would, I didn't know any chefs. I'd never met a chef. Right. And so I thought, like, okay, now I just got to figure out, the guys I know who own restaurants are people who made a lot of money.
Yeah.
And then they bought a restaurant.
Right.
I was like, so I got to go figure out how to make a lot of money so I can buy a restaurant.
So one you were day. Thinking like owner.
Yeah, I was like, okay, you know, I'm going to go to college. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go get in, you know, a business degree. I was studying accounting, and I was like, then I'll go to law school, become a lawyer, and try to make a bunch of money so I could buy a restaurant.
Okay.
That was like my 25-year plan.
Yeah. How old are you when you're thinking, is this like 17 year of high school?
Yeah, yeah. I was probably 17 years old. Yeah. And I was like, that's what I'm going to do. That's going to be the thing. I'm going to open, you know. And, you know, I thought at the time I worked at, and it's a good restaurant still there, but it was like, you know, it's a neighborhood bar and grill. And I was like, man, this place is like top notch. This is top. Uh-huh. This is like top.
What was
tier.
Their thing? Like, what was the thing that they did that was like, that people came in for?
The one thing people came in for, we did pizzas pretty well there. And we had an Italian sausage and jardiniere pizza. Mm. And that was like, you know, pretty well known.
That was the thing.
Throughout the parts, that like, that was one of the things.
Okay.
But, you know, it was like, I remember just, it was thinking
but that
like,
to you was like the mountaintop.
I was like, wow.
Right.
Like, this is like, to own a place like this would be incredible.
I have to ask. So can I ask how old you are?
Yeah, 32.
32. Okay. So when you, at this point in your life, right, were you watching cooking shows on television? Did you have cookbooks? Like when you say you didn't know any chefs, but did you have that sort of... you know, the vision of chefs one could get through sort of entertainment or publishing, or did you not focus on that at all?
No, I didn't, you know, I didn't really know anything about that. And I didn't know anyone who kind of, who watched cooking shows or, mm-hmm. you know, and then I didn't really start to get into that. I didn't have any cookbooks. I didn't, you know, I'd never looked at a cookbook.
Yeah.
I think my mom had the Joy of Cooking at home, uh-huh. and that was one we would reference every once in a while to make, like, cookies or something.
When you wanted to, yeah, when you needed a basic recipe.
But it was kind of, I just would kind of try to make stuff and mess around with things. And,
yeah.
you know, I knew things I liked, so then I figured out how things taste, and, you know, that's how I would kind of cook then.
Yeah.
And then when I was in college... You know, more shows started to come out that were, you know, cooking focused. And, you know, mm-hmm. that was kind of the dawn of the Top Chef era. Right. And it was, you know, these more shows on Food Network.
Yeah.
And I started seeing these things. And I'm like, I think that was a realization for me. Like, wait, like, people made a career out of this.
Right.
Like, you cook for a career.
Right.
And I was...
You could come from the bottom up instead of... coming in as an owner. Like
right.
this flipped your worldview.
Right. And yeah. I was like, I had taken a job. I worked at this, like basically there's this really like fancy food court on Michigan Avenue over here. And that was the first place they really let me cook. And I was just like making pizzas, sandwiches, wraps, but I made it all the way up to the stir fry station,
okay.
which then was a very big deal. and I actually got to like cook. And it was like, I thought it was the coolest shit in the world. And I remember I was like, I didn't know how anything worked, but they were just like, do you know how to do this? And I was like, yep, I know how to do this. I got this. I totally got this.
And you would wing it.
And I would wing it. And it was like, I mean, I remember I burnt myself so bad because I'd never cooked tofu before and I didn't understand the whole water and oil situation.
Yeah.
I lit up one of the woks, filled it with oil. I threw a bag of tofu in and the whole, you know, it shot up fire like all the way up into my armpits.
I mean,
little burns in my armpits. And I remember the lady in line was like, are you okay? Is it supposed to do that? And I was like, oh no, that just does that every time. That's how
right.
tofu
part
cooks.
Of the show. It's part of the show.
That's how tofu like, cooks. Right. It's super flammable. But, you know.
I got to interrupt you for 1 second.
No, go ahead.
You're talking about, you know, home cooking, right? Italian food in that situation. You're talking about the, you know, the pub or whatever you called it that you worked in that had the sausage and jardiniere pizza, right? And all this. You know, you're now in, you know, whatever word you want to call it. It's a fairly fancy restaurant, right? Spiaggia.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like you were well served by coming up for as long as you did, like almost until you were 20, cooking... you know, everyday food. Maybe it tasted great, but do you feel like that kind of allowed you to sort of maintain, you know, like a focus on just things tasting awesome? Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, you know, I think it was hugely beneficial because it was just such a different side to, like, there's the restaurant industry that's all, you know what I mean, the glory of the, you
the
know,
1%,
Michelin
the
stars.
The 1%ers.
And the, you know,
yeah, the 1% of the restaurant business.
And, you know, it's like, but this is like, this is the everybody, you know, they own a restaurant in the neighborhood.
Right.
Trying to grind it out. How much work it actually is.
Yeah.
Like what people's lives actually yeah. were like. I felt like it taught me a lot about that.
Yeah.
How hard it was.
Yeah.
Seeing people struggle with that. Seeing, you know, people who, like my best friend's dad, who was managing the business and trying to manage it with his family life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I was really intertwined in that from a young age with them, kind of in a weird way. And it gave me a lot of perspective on that. And it, you know, and I think it's just always kept my cooking style very, very down to earth and mm-hmm. very, like, it needs to be approachable. People need to feel comfortable. I mean, the first like real nice restaurant I worked at was a week after I started culinary school. I started at Table 52 working for Art mm-hmm. Smith. And I spent 2 years there. And I remember just being like, I couldn't get a back of the house job because I didn't have enough experience, but they said I could work front of the house. So they gave me a job front of the house. And it was like, oh, yeah, I worked front of the house. You know, I was a barback. I was a busboy. I answered phones. I delivered pizzas. Mm-hmm. I, you know, worked the door if I happened to be the biggest guy there that night. Mm-hmm. Like, whatever you need. And then I went into working to a restaurant where the general manager and the AGM were both had been working for Charlie Trotter for the past 20 years.
Oh, my God. Okay.
And, you know, I was like, I didn't know my ass
that's
from my elbows.
That's like bull in a china shop time.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, yeah, you know, you just like go fat. And they're like, you know, no, like you didn't even set that in the right spot. I was like, there's a right spot.
Right.
Like, you know, you just put the fucking shit on the table and like people eat. Right. And they're like, oh, my God. Like, but, you know, they showed me the way. And that was.
Did you like that when it was when you were forget the initial moment of shock? Once you kind of got oriented to it, did you like that degree of specificity, fussiness, formality?
I liked that there was systems, uh-huh. that there were kind of, you know, all these, like, you know, I felt like there were more, like, traditions and rules of, like, where things went and how things worked.
Yeah.
And I'm not the best rule follower.
Okay.
But I thought it was interesting. I thought it was really cool. And I didn't know there were people out there that took service this seriously. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that there was service this good. I didn't know about any of these things and like real wine lists. And like we were selling bottles of wine for, you know, a couple $1,000s. And I was like, this is, you know, I worked at a bar and grill where it's like we had Blue Moon and that was
right.
a big
and house
fucking
wine.
Deal.
And house wine.
Like, yeah, we had like a $7 beer on draft and people are like, ooh, that place is expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And so going into that and, you know, I remember the first time my dad came in and, you know, me and my dad grew up 5 blocks away from where I grew up on the South Side. He comes in and he, you know, sits at the bar and feeding him some food. And, you know, somebody's asking me like, oh, sir, what would you like to drink? He's like, well, I'll take a light, you know? And they're like, sorry. I'm like, you want some Miller Lite? And they're like, oh, we don't have that. And he's like, all right, you know, whatever. I'll take a, you know, your Coors Light. That's fine. They're like, oh no, we don't have that.
Yeah.
He's like, well, fine. I'll drink a Bud Light. Like, whatever. They're like, no, we don't have that. And he's like, and he looks at me, he's like, I thought you said this was like a nice place you worked at. You can't even get like a Miller Lite here. I was like, no, it's like so nice they don't have Miller Lite, Dad.
Right.
He's like, I don't understand what you mean. And like that was like, you know, like I felt like my where my gap was bridging between, you know, the places I cooked in coming up to where I was cooking at now.
Yeah. Although what's interesting to me is, you know, I don't look at it. I didn't start to be around restaurants like the one we're sitting in right now till I was almost 30.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I grew up in South Florida.
Mm-hmm.
I went, you know, the Grotto Azzurri, the Blue Grotto Italian restaurant with garlic knots. And, you know, we had that place and Allen's Drugstore, you know, with a lunch counter. And, but I, to this day, I feel like they may not measure how far away the napkin is from the glass and all that stuff. But you can have super genuine hospitality.
Oh, I think
in those places, it can be unbelievably, they may not care about that stuff, but they will make you feel super welcome. They'll fall over backwards to make you happy,
mm-hmm.
you know? And there are places that would have gone out and gotten your dad the beer he wanted from the corner grocery.
Oh, for sure. We would have went and gotten it for him.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
it was just like one of those things. Yeah. I was like, just have a different beer, man.
Right.
but, you know, like those were like the funny things to me from the chain. Yeah. And I think, yeah, those places, like, they were real hospitalities. And I remember I worked with this bartender who was this little Italian guy, Ray. And Ray drove this little slick silver Datsun convertible, and he was like the coolest guy you ever met. You know what I mean? He looked like mm-hmm. he was one of Sinatra's buddies. He was mm-hmm. like a little bit older when I was, you know, in high school. He was probably like mid-50s, but yeah. he was like cool. Like all the young 20-year-old girls had like a crush on this guy, and he was just, but he was behind the bar. This guy was magic. You know what I mean? He knew yep. everybody's name. He knew their drink. He knew what they liked, you know, and just, you know, could break up a fight with words and just mm-hmm. like that guy to me was hospitality. Like mm-hmm. he knew how it worked. He knew how it was done.
Yeah.
And everybody loved him.
Yeah.
And it was just like, to me, that was like my first lesson. And like, it didn't matter what he was serving. It didn't matter what he was doing.
Yes.
But it's like, you know, he's the kind of guy, he'd see his two regulars walk in and he'd order their pizza before they sit down so it would come out faster. And, you know, and like shit like that, that I was like, man, that's so, you know, slick.
Yeah.
But it's like just good hospitality.
Yeah.
That's all
yeah.
it is.
Yeah. There are these people who seem to be, I mean, the kind of thing people have it in a kitchen where you're just, you have your senses work the right way.
Right.
You know, I mean, you'll know better than me, but I've been in kitchens where, you know, a chef will hear something behind him or her.
Yeah.
And say, hey, Johnny, you better check on the whatever.
Yeah.
Because they can hear how hard something is sizzling or,
uh-huh.
right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Or they can smell something.
Right.
That is to me breathtaking.
Yeah. It's like they just have, you know, such a great feel. Right.
It's like spider sense
of like what's going on.
Yeah.
In their restaurant,
they're attuned.
Like they know what it sounds like. Yeah. They know. Yeah. You know who's doing what. And yeah. They know it's like if a certain person is roasting that thing. Like they remember the time they burnt it 9.5 months
ago. And there's that
ago.
Too. Right. 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 The institutional knowledge.
Right. You know, where it's like you don't know what day it is today, but I remember, you know, Tuesday, November 17th, 2017, when you burnt those six, you know, pork shanks.
Right, right. So where do you go from table 52?
So I was at table 52 for 2 years. And at that time, you know, that was like the hottest restaurant in town. Mm-hmm. You know, the Obamas coming in, all these famous celebrities coming in. It was just incredible. And I was there for 2 years. And I left. I was like, you know, I'm ready to go out and do the next thing. And I was feeling like, you know, top of the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm important because I work in an important restaurant. So I left to go open this restaurant with these guys. And it's just a line cook. And we went and we worked there for about 2 months. We got it open. We were open for 3 days. And on the fourth day, the chef called us into the dining room and he said, listen, we're done.
Okay.
He said, pack your shit.
Okay.
He goes, we're done. There's no money. The restaurant's closing.
After 4 days?
Uh-huh. So that was like my first really good lesson in like, you don't know anything. Right. And like this industry will put you on your ass at any given second.
Now you're being very vague about, I'm not asking who these people were, but did you have any inkling as you guys were getting ready to open that there was turmoil in the background?
Yes. I should, you know, in retrospect, you're like, oh man, like, you know, looking at it now, you know, I was, I think 22 or 23 years old.
Yeah.
Looking at it now, it's like, what were you thinking? You know, I didn't really know who the partners were. It was never really clear.
Yeah.
You know, where money was coming from.
Right.
It was just like a lot of things. Like, you know, I interviewed for the job and they're like, yeah, it's good. And I'm like, what's the name of the place? And they're like, we're still working on that, but we're really close to opening. And then it was like, you know, the name of the place was terrible. It was called Johnny D's.
Okay.
Is what they went with because that was the original chef's name and he had walked out, but they did, you know, they had filed all the paperwork under that name.
Yeah.
It was like all these like huge, huge red flags in retrospect.
Billboards. Yeah.
You know, like it was just all the alarms were going off, but you know, it's 23.
Yeah.
And
now, what was like, your role? Were you a line cook there?
Yeah, I was a line cook there.
Okay.
But you know, there wasn't a lot of us that worked there. It was like five people. You know, there was a chef, a sous chef, and three line cooks.
Okay. So at what point do you start to have a sense of like who you're going to be as a chef? Are you thinking in those terms yet at this point in your life?
I think I was, but you know, it's weird. I feel like it goes through such huge like ebb and flows of like what you think. And it's, you know, somebody asked me the other day, they're like, did you ever like question yourself during your career coming up? And it's like, yeah, every 3 to 6 months. I mean, like, what am I doing? You know, it's like I dropped out of college and now I'm cooking and my friends who I went to college with now are, you know, they're in law school or working successful jobs or doing big things. And it's like, I'm making $10 an hour and like haven't, you know, seen a Saturday night before 3 a.m. in 4 years and like what, you know, like, and you know, I think at that time you're like, oh, everything's fine, it's okay. You know, you're young and dumb enough to believe in anything.
Right. Or recover from anything.
And recover from anything. Yeah, I didn't have any serious, you know, I was living in my parents' basement on the South Side. I had no serious anythings. Mm-hmm. So from there I went and I worked at the University Club of Chicago for the chef named Mark Baker. He was an old school chef here in Chicago. He ran Four Seasons forever, you know, opened Four Seasons all over the world. It was just like old school French technique, hard-nosed chef, like, you know, didn't talk to you, busted, you know, just unbelievable balls, but was insanely skilled.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked there. I spent exactly 365 days there.
Okay.
I did my 1 year.
You're talking about it in like prison time. That's like prison. Were you like scoring the days on the your station on wall?
And it was, I learned a ton there, and it was great. But it was just like, it was just not the kitchen environment for me. And I remember I put in my 2 week notice. I went into the chef's office. I said, "Chef, I'm giving you my 2 week notice. Thank you for the opportunity here. It's been fantastic."
Yeah.
And he said, "Okay." And I walked out. And I remember the executive sous chef goes, "Wow, he must really like you. He didn't just throw you out right now." And I was like, "Well, that's him really liking me, huh? That I can serve my notice." And but you know, that's the kind of place it was.
Yeah.
And,
tough love.
From there, I went and I took a job with Stephanie Izzard because she was about to open Girl on the Goat.
Okay, so you were there. You were there for the opening too.
Yeah.
That's cool. I ate there right around the time it opened.
And that was, you know, Steph was one of those people. I met her, you know, I went for the interview.
Yeah.
And it was just instantly, I was like, don't care what you're paying, don't care what you're doing, I'm going to work for you.
Wow.
It was just like, I knew, like we, you know, I went to this interview and I showed up. I remember it was, I showed up like 45 minutes early. And, you know, I was dressed in like business casual clothes and nice shoes on and pants. And like, I went and got a coffee so I wasn't too early and like came back like 20 minutes early. So I'm sitting there waiting. 20 minutes goes by, 30, 40, you know. Finally, like 45 minutes after we're supposed to meet, Steph rolls in, her and her CDC, my buddy Jan. They roll in and they're both just like, they're wearing T-shirts and chef pants and they're filthy from the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I stand up and I'm like, "Oh, hi, chef. How are you?" And I shake her hand. She just looks at me, kind of looks up. And she goes, "Fuck, you're tall, huh?" And she looks at her chef de cuisine and goes, "Well, if nothing else, at least he could reach those high shelves to put the plate on him." And, you know, then we sat down and we talked for, I mean, 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I was like, this is what I've been looking for. This is what I need. You know, she was so the antithesis of all the fine dining, of all the machismo, of, you know, flavor. She just wanted flavor over everything, and she wanted to do what she wanted. And
but the other thing to me about what struck me when I ate there for the first time is there's a lot of her in that food. There's a lot of personality in that food.
Without a doubt.
There's a lot of things that I'm sure come from jobs she's had or places she's lived or stuff her family. You can tell. It was eclectic, but it all made sense.
Yeah. And I think that restaurant, when you go in there and it's like the more you know Steph, I feel like I walk in that restaurant and I'm like, this is Steph.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It feels like her, the vibe, the energy, the food, just the service. It's like, it was such, you know, a great iteration of her. It was just, you know, so well done in that way. And I think it's because she took so much ownership of it. She took so much control of it. It's still, you know, you can't be hired as a hostess there and not meet Steph, you know, and it's just like...
To this day. Good for her.
And that's how Steph is. And that's what was so impressive about her was just like, there was no amount of work she was afraid to do. There was no amount of anything that she felt entitled to and that, you know, she had done things before and that would lead to success. She felt like, you know, she had to prove everything to everyone and she did it every day and was just like, this place is going to be the best every day. And it wasn't about, you know, awards and stars and any of that. It was just like,
yeah,
it's just about like, food's going to be awesome and this place is going to be super fun.
So what did you learn there? Because in addition to everything you just said, that is a big restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
How many seats does that place have?
It's about 130 seats, and then plus it's a big bar and lounge. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the other thing about that place, though, people are like, oh, it's, is that it opens at 4:30,
mm-hmm.
And when it opens at 4:30, the bar fills up. The restaurant fills up. At 4:30, at 4:34,
yeah,
it's a full restaurant.
I was one of, that's when I ate there, I was one of those people.
I so vividly remember, like, so many of Steph's dishes. And it's just from, you know, the first time I tasted them and just, like, being in that moment of, like, you know, those flavor combinations. And just, like, they were so strong. And it was just, like, seeing really what went into her getting there. You know, because it's, like, I think I always had this misconception of, like, you know, chefs just work places and they know and they just put it together. And not, you know, the level of research, the level of thought, you know, taking things from her travel. She was so good at that, you know. And I felt like one thing Steph really taught me is, like, you know, you would go and you would eat somewhere with her. And, you know, you'd talk about the food after. And the conversations we would have about the food were different. They weren't like, you know, I feel like you go out and you eat with a lot of chefs and it's like, okay, you leave there and now let's go shit on everything about that restaurant that we didn't like. You see the busboy's shoes, how scuffed they were, my fork was dirty, that glass was no, you know, whatever. Steph was looking at what can I take from there?
Right.
Like, what did I just learn? Yeah. Like, that's how I felt like every meal with Steph was like, what did I just learn?
Regardless of what percentage of the experience that might be.
Right. And she might not like something, but she'd also be like, if she did like something, she'd be like, oh, I really like this about this. And then you'd see that weeks later in something, and you're like, that's that thing. And, you know, and it was just like, there was a brilliance to that. It kind of almost, you know, when they talk about music and they talk about people who, like, they can, you know, listen to a song and play it.
Yeah.
Like, I always felt like Steph was like the master of that with food, where it's like you'd feed her a dish and she could make it. You know, and it's like she was really good at that. And a lot of that, you know, she does research and she looks into things and she has an incredible team now. But, you know, that was always so impressive about her.
Yeah.
It's just seeing, you know, what it took to, like, how much hard work and how much thought really went into everything. And I was like, oh, wow. Like, you know, and that was, you know, it ended up being the thing that actually pushed me out of there, because I was like, I don't know anything. Is what I felt like. I'm like, I need to learn so much more. I need to push myself so much harder. Like, you know, I'm not ready to keep, you know, because eventually she made me a tournant. She made me a junior sous chef. She made me a sous chef while I was there.
Can we just say, it's rare that I stop a conversation to explain a term on this show, but some people may not know what a tournant is, but that's basically it's like a floater.
Yeah, the tournant.
You're trained on it. You can work any station. You can cover if somebody calls in sick. Mm-hmm. You can cover when someone's on vacation.
Yeah. So you were, you know, basically there was two of us. It was me and my buddy Aaron. And it was, we basically each, our week would start at one end of the line.
Yeah.
And we'd work our way towards each other. We just gave everybody a day off. So, you know, you'd work 5 days, you worked five stations. You'd work 6 days, you worked six stations.
Great experience for you, right?
And yeah, you just, you know, it made you just like, okay, like, you know, but it'd be, you know, it's funny. You'd walk into the walk-in sometimes. You'd be looking at the shelves. You're like, what station am I working?
Yeah.
Where am I getting mise-en-place?
It's like being the understudy for every part in a play.
Yeah. And but it's, you know, incredible experience. And the idea is, you know, that it's supposed to be kind of, you're supposed to be kind of the lead line cooks. And that's why you could work every station. Mm-hmm. It's because you've done them all, you know them all. And that was a really challenging but really amazing experience. And it just, yeah, I learned so much. And it's like, that's a big restaurant. We're doing 500-600 covers a night. And it was like, you never were prepped enough.
Mm-hmm.
You never could be set enough. It was like every day, it was like, you know, we'd always joke, we'd get somebody new in and they'd be like, well, how many covers are we doing tonight? And it's like, all of them. Like, don't fucking worry about it. Just keep prepping until you have no more
we'll
time
tell you
to
when,
prep.
We'll tell you when to stop.
And then you won't have enough shit.
Yeah.
And I'm going to yell at you for not having enough shit.
Uh-huh.
And that was, you know, every day there for 2 years. But it was incredible. I loved working there.
Yeah.
I loved working with staff. I mean, some of the teams that I was a part of there were just absolutely insane.
But the way you're describing this kind of shift in your, you know, when you just said you realized you didn't really know anything and you really needed to bear down. And did you, was it that explicit a thought that you had at some point while you were there? Like you actually, like a light, it was like what they call a light bulb moment. You actually recognized that in real time?
Yeah, it was kind of one of those things. Steph was getting ready to open Little Goat.
Uh-huh.
And she wanted me to go be a part of that. And I was going to go and I was going to leave Girl and the Goat, Big Goat, to be a part of Little Goat. And I remember it was kind of, we were walking through Little Goat for the first time and it was just a construction zone. And I remember after that, I was just like, I'm not ready for this. I need to go do something else. I need to learn more. And I just felt like, you know, Steph kind of, she had created this itch in me for Asian food. And, you know, Bill Kim at the time was opening a restaurant called Belly Q. And I had known Bill for a couple of years, so I hit him up, and he was looking for a sous chef, and I went and talked to him. And, you know, that really kind of let me down that rabbit hole. And I was like, because we were doing these things, we're using these ingredients that, you know, for stuff that I knew a little bit about, you know, going to the Korean store for the first time and tasting the kimchi. And I was just like, what is this stuff? This is crazy. Like, this isn't anything I'm used to. I was like, I need to go more down this rabbit hole. This is something I need to learn more about. And as much as I'm learning about it here, I'm also learning about 500 other things. I need to kind of like, basically like take a little bit, you know, a few more electives in this. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at your, like, I always like to look at a culinary career kind of like college, because it's
totally,
like, you know, until you own your own place, it's like basically you're getting paid some money to go to college.
Right. But like I also say, no, but I also say what cooks do, I think a lot of people outside the business don't realize this, at least cooks who are working smart, is you're essentially assembling your own curriculum as you go from job to job until you decide it's time to graduate, right? Which is when you decide you're ready to be a chef.
Right.
The chef of a restaurant.
Right. You know, and I think it's you know.
And the beauty of it is that you can adjust as you go.
Right. And I always talk to my cooks and I say, you know, your cooking's your undergrad. And your line cook, it's your undergrad.
Yeah.
You need a little bit of money. It's a little bit more broad. It's a little bit more out there.
Right.
I go, and it might be for 4 years and it might be for 7 years. It depends on the kind of person you are.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I go, and then you make a sous chef. And I go, that's your master's. You get a little bit more focused in. Figure out what you want to do. You get a little bit more skills that are more high end. You know, you're learning more butchery, pasta making, whatever it is.
Yeah.
I go, and then, you know, eventually you're going to be chef de cuisine somewhere. And I go, now you're a PhD candidate. You're just working on your thesis. And your thesis is going to be your restaurant. So, you know, what is the research you need to do to complete that?
Yeah.
And that's, you know, the way I like to look at it. I'm like, I think if you look at it in terms of education, it's a little bit easier to explain our career to people who might not get it. Of like, you know, because a lot of times in cooking, they're like, oh, I'd be like, oh, yeah, I quit this job to take that job. They're like, oh, well, it probably pays a lot more, right? And it's like, no, it pays less.
Right.
Well, the hours are probably better. No, the hours are worse. So why did you take that job? It's like, because it's a better job. They're like, but that's, you didn't describe a better job.
Well,
it's like, you know.
I love this analogy. I've used the curriculum analogy myself when I talk about your line of work. The other thing, which sounds overly romanticized, but I think it's also helpful of people, instead of thinking it like, you know, instead of thinking of the financial reward, you know, in your early days, and this will sound absurd, but maybe not to you, you are literally, in an old-fashioned medieval sense almost, you are on a quest for knowledge.
Yeah.
That's what young cooks are doing. Now, that sounds maybe precious and crazy, but I don't think you find it that.
No, it's not.
Because that's what you are doing.
It's not. And it's like you have to wrap your brain around that.
Right.
And say, hey, for, you know, this amount of time in my life, I need to live a certain way.
Yeah.
To be able to chase this craft.
To become who I want to be.
You know, be who I want to be.
Yeah.
I have to be willing to sacrifice.
Yes.
And I have to be willing to say, you know what, like, and it sucks. And people are like, yeah, you know, we need to pay cooks a living wage. And I think we do. And it's like, but, you know, until we can figure out how to get there, it's like, if you want to do this, you have to figure out a way to say, you know what, I'm going to live off 20 something grand a year for 4 to 6 years of my life and just figure it out. And I'm going to scrape by, I'm going to get it and just make it happen. And, you know, but that's a hard pill to swallow when, you know, you're 23, 24 years old and you have friends graduating college who are making, you know, 60, 70, 80 grand a year, especially living in cities like Chicago or New York, and, you know, they're out partying and doing all these things, and you're like, man, like, all right, like, you know, you'd be at the end of the night on the line like, okay, who, you got $7? All right, I got 5. He's got 3. We can get a 30 rack.
Right.
And like, we'll all go sit in the alley and drink it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's like, but then next week we get paid. And like,
okay, but do you not, like, I've heard actors interviewed, right, and they talk about, you know, actors meaning like movie stars, and they talk about their days when they were, you know, waiting tables and auditioning and living with roommates, and not unlike a young cook, right?
Yeah.
But they look back on that time really fondly.
Yeah.
Don't you look back on this time like with, I like, said, a lot, you know, of affection?
Being a line cook, it's like college.
Right.
It's like you still don't have real responsibilities. Your responsibility is your station.
Right.
So it's like you can still kind of go out a lot. You know, it's like most people aren't, you know,
as long as you can as long as you can pull yourself off the mat the next morning.
Right. And you're young enough that you can. Right. And it's like, you know, it's like a bunch of college age kids who like almost nobody's in a serious relationship. And you're just like, it's your wild and crazy days. You know, those first couple of years I spent line cooking were like insanity.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's really fun and you meet some amazing people and you have amazing experiences.
Yeah.
And I think it's an important part of the process.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? It's good to be like, keep getting pushed to your breaking point.
Yeah.
Because that's the only way I think you expand it. It's like, you got to keep getting pushed there to be like, can I push a little further?
Rather stay inside. 100 Bogart has made much progress over the past year since their grand opening. They are a growing community of professional freelancers, entrepreneurs, and startups. Their dedicated team guarantees you receive a productive and worry-free work environment. 100 Bogart is currently filling up their 2-person to 12-person private offices. The spacious pop-up gallery, premier rooftop, and brand new full floor with terrace are available for your next event. Podcast rooms, conference rooms, and meeting spaces are also available for booking. 100 Bogart hosts events like art exhibitions, pop-up stores, product launches, and fashion shows. Heritage Radio Network is a proud member of the 100 Bogart community and often holds events in the building. Visit 100bogart.com to schedule a tour and learn more.
Welcome back to the show. We are going to get you right back to the rest of our interview with Chef Joe Flam of Spiaggia Restaurant. Before we do, Caitlin, just my weekly reminder to everybody, if you would like to stay in touch with the show, the best way to do that is simply to subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. You can also, if you don't want to do that or don't know how to do that, which is the case for some people, it's okay. Nothing to be ashamed about. You can follow the show on social media. The easiest place to do that is on Instagram, and it is at Chef Podcast. Every time we drop a new show, I do post a photograph and I do put a link in the bio that stays up for at least a day, sometimes several days, and you can keep in touch with us that way. If you would like to follow me personally, I am Toqueland Andrew on Twitter and Instagram, Toqueland Andrew on Instagram and Twitter. And as always, if you'd be kind enough to rate the show or write us a little review on Stitcher or iTunes, we would really appreciate it. It does help people find us. And with that, let's return you to the rest of our conversation with Chef Joe Flam at Spiaggia Restaurant. I hope you enjoy the rest of it. So before we get into you kind of coming into your own as a chef, right? Can you just talk about Chicago for 1 minute?
Sure.
You're from Chicago. You've basically spent your life here.
Yeah.
How do you characterize Chicago? This is a broad question, right?
Sure.
But we had this dinner here last night, and we were talking at the table, and I'm visiting from New York, but I've been here before, and I've written about the city, and I've interviewed a bunch of chefs from Chicago. It is, to me, this very interesting, not just interesting, it's a fascinating crossroads of classic American and state-of-the-art contemporary.
Yeah.
Right? So you have, and someone at the table said to me, you better not say meat and potatoes, which I wasn't going to say. But, you know, I was riding around in some taxis yesterday and I was passing, like, you know, places with names like The Grill and, you know, these places that are very classically Chicago. People still talk about pizza here. People still talk about, you know, beef sandwich here. You know, there are these things that the butchery culture of this city. This is also, by far, I don't even think there's a close second, the only city in the United States where I think, whatever you want to call it, the molecular modernist, whatever you want to call that movement, has a real foothold. Like, it's to me, it's the only city where it's ever really found a home.
Yeah, I think.
And it's fascinating to me that both of those things and everything in between exists here. And I've never really been able to understand why.
You know,
does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it totally makes sense to me. And I think the thing about Chicago that I think is really interesting to me is the restaurant industry here is made up of a lot of people and a lot of chefs who aren't from Chicago. You know, a lot of chefs I meet, they're like, oh, wow, you're actually from here. You grew up here and, you know, lived here. And, you know, it may, I like feel like a townie. But, you know, they kind of, but in Chicago itself, there's still a ton of people who are from here who live here. And I think that's what's different. Just, you know, from a cultural perspective here, as when you go to New York, when you go to L.A., San Francisco, you meet so many people and nobody's like, oh, yeah, I grew up in the Bay Area. Nobody's like, you know, I mean, there's some people, but it's like not as prevalent as like when you're in Chicago, you're walking down the street in Chicago, you meet so many people who, you know, they're born here, they lived here. But there is still, you know, a large population that does come in mm-hmm. from other places. So I think it makes it two things. It makes it a very international city because there are both sides of that coin, but it's also, it's like, we're a Midwestern city. Mm-hmm. Like, we're a big Midwestern city. Mm-hmm. So as much it's like, you know, we're a big city, it's like we're still kind of Midwestern.
But what does that mean in the context of the question I asked?
And I think what that means is, so we have the ability to look at these things coming in, you know, the Grants who are opening Alinea and doing some of the craziest things anyone's ever seen.
Yes.
And be able to look at that and appreciate it. And, you know, like have a Picasso statue in Daly Square and be right. like, this is crazy, you know, and they did that 50 years ago. But it also means that it's like, you know, you don't want to say it, but I'll say it. There's some meat and potatoes ass pizza here. You know, uh-huh. people here. And it's like,
you're saying that food is, that's the stuff that the natives want.
I think the natives appreciate both, but I think they're both here is the thing. Right. And I think that's how Chicago is it doesn't just fit in one little foothold.
No.
Is it has these two things. I mean, still, every year when they come out the list of busiest restaurants, almost every year it's Gibson's. Mm-hmm. You know, Gibson's Steakhouse down mm-hmm. the street from here. You go there, incredible hospitality. It's just, they do the steakhouse hospitality. Yeah. They do it well. It's like Luger's in New York, yeah. you know, same deal. But, you know, people aren't afraid to go out of that box either. It's here. It's quintessential. You yeah. know what I mean? And I think that's the thing about it in Chicago. And Chicago appreciates the quintessential stuff. But I think it's also a place where people aren't afraid to take risk and they're not yeah. afraid to be adventurous. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah, but see, what's so interesting to me, and this is a compliment to this city, right, is, you know, because I used to talk to Wiley Dufresne, and mm-hmm. he used to say, you know, WD-50 was the only restaurant of its kind in New York. And that used to stop me in my tracks. And it was true. You know,
mm-hmm.
and that's New York, right?
Yeah.
Where you think that stuff would make logical sense, right? In Chicago, and I agree, I constantly in conversations remind people this is a Midwestern city because it is a huge city. It gets grouped with the coastal cities, but it is unmistakably a Midwestern city.
Yeah.
It is also unlike a New York or certainly unlike any big city on the East Coast. It's the only big fish, really. Where it is, like you're not, you, and if you're in New York, you can hop on a train and go to Boston and Philly and D.C. and these, you know, Chicago's kind of it right here.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
but I do find it fascinating that the avant-garde piece is taken off here.
Yeah, I think
it's a huge credit to the city, but I've never been able to quite understand it.
It's a city that supports, you know, people who are trying to do things in the city. I think is one, you know. Good way to put it. It's like the chefs who do well here, you know, they came here, they train here, they live here, they have their restaurant here. I think those are the chefs who do really well in Chicago. Mm-hmm. I think chefs have a really hard time coming in from out of town and putting restaurants here. I think that's a struggle because, you know, it's like...
You mean people who try to, like, import a concept or...
Right. Yeah. You know, I think that's a struggle for people in Chicago. But I think if you're willing to put the time and work in Chicago, I think Chicago's like, yeah, okay, we'll check out what you're doing. They're not afraid of the avant-garde. They're not afraid of checking it out, you know, and I think and I think also, you know, fine dining happened later in Chicago and New York. So I think 100%. It affords us 100%. To be...
Well, certainly on the American front, yes.
Yeah, for the American front, for sure.
Yeah.
But it's like, we get to be more contemporary.
Yes.
And, you know... And I think that's a huge part of it, too, is that, you know, there aren't even the old institutions here. The old institutions are kind of, you know, those Gibsons, those Gene and Giorgettis, and they're very, you know, they are those very meat and potatoes. Mm-hmm. So then when we said, okay, we're coming in with this new guard, there was no rules. There was nobody saying, well, you know, well, fine dining in Chicago has always been this. No, fine dining in Chicago was meat and potatoes, and that's what it was. So when, you know, guys like, you know, Grant and other chefs who are doing crazy stuff, and even the ones who are now, you know, you look at what, you know, Noah Sandoval's doing at Oriole, or, you know, what John's doing over at Smith, and you're just like, because there was no rules here of like what fine dining had to be. And I think that's a big part of it, where they were just like, all right, well, that was, you know, it was a New York structure, but it was like a wild, wild west frontier of like, we could do whatever the hell we want.
Right. And if you do it well, people here, there's going to be an audience for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for all that. All right. Let's talk about you. What did you call it? You graduating, getting your master's.
Yeah.
Talk about you elevating to chefdom. When did you decide you were ready for that?
You know, I worked for Bill for 2 years, and when I was there, I had Zach Su, who I worked for, who had worked in New York, and he had worked with, you know, Rick Terizzi, he had worked with Mario Carbone, and all these incredible, you know, he worked at Cafe Belluti, he worked for Cremolini. And, you know, he said to me one day, he goes, you know, you got to go do Italian at some point. He's like, you've done all this, like, heavy-hitting food. He's like, you got to learn balance, man. He's like, you got to learn some lightness, some delicateness. And, you know, I was like, okay. Like, yeah, I've always wanted to. I just, you know, I haven't hit that step yet. So we started talking about it more, and we're talking to Bill about it, and I was like, I think I want to go do Italian next. And I was like, where do I go? And he's like, well, there's only one place.
Right.
He's like, you go to Spiaggia.
Yeah.
He goes, you go work for Tony.
Yeah.
And he goes, and you learn.
Yeah.
So, you know, a few months later, Tony happened to be looking for a sous chef. They were reconcepting the dining room in here, just redoing it.
Did you two know each other at all?
No. We never met. I saw him in an airport one time when I was sitting with Stephanie Azard. And I remember I was like, there's Tony Montuano.
Yeah.
And it was like, this was early enough in Steph's career where she was like humble bragging to me that she knew him.
Uh-huh.
She was like, oh, I know him.
Yeah.
We were also wearing matching velour jumpsuits at the time, so we didn't say hi. but... You know, I'd done the stage, I'd done the interview with all the other chefs, and then me and him sat down, and we talked for, like, you know, an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just, like, I laughed, and I was like, man, this guy is so cool. Like, and I remember I called my buddy, Joe, who's a chef in Detroit, and I was like, dude, I just interviewed with Tony Montuano. He's like, with him? I was like, yeah. Like, we just sat down and talked for an hour, and he's like, that's the coolest. Like, and... So I came on here, Tony gave me a shot, and after a year, the chef de cuisine was leaving. And so I sat down with Tony, and I just said, hey, you know what, like, I think I'm ready to make a run at this.
Yeah.
I go, if you give me the opportunity, I go, nobody will work harder for you. I go, I know I don't know everything, but, you know, I go, I'll try. And I go, I think I can do this, like, if you give me a shot. And it was just kind of one of those. And I didn't know if I was ready, and I wasn't sure if I was ready. But I knew I was at least ready to try. And I thought, well, maybe this will, you know, just be me falling flat on my face in a year and having to, you know, figure out something else and, you know.
What was his initial reaction? Was he surprised or was he, you think he was expecting it?
No, he was into it.
Yeah.
And he was like, yeah. He's like, let's do it, man. So that sounds great.
On the spot, in that conversation?
And it was just like, okay, here we go. Right. So I started slowly, you know, learning, grinding, building my team, making mistakes, just, you know. But Tony was always supportive, and he was always such a great sounding board. And it was just, you know, I'd be like, hey, I'm thinking of doing this. And he'd be like, well, this is how you do this. And, like, you can't call it that because it's not that. And, you know, always kept me straight on all the liberties I take with the Italian language. And we started working together, and I felt like, you know, after a year, I was like, okay, I survived my first year. I didn't lose the Michelin star. We kept it. And I, like, you know.
What was that pressure like?
I was
waiting for the guide.
I was horrible. The first year, it was horrible. I was just terrified. I was like, oh, my God. Like, what if I dropped the torch for Tony? And he was, you know, the whole time, he's like, don't worry about it. It's good. We're good, Joe. We got this. And I'm like, I couldn't sleep the night before. I, like, woke up at, like, 6 a.m. I'm, like, you know, just doing a million things, like, waiting for the call.
Yeah.
I finally came, and it was like, oh, my God. But it was, you know, that first year was really hard. And then I felt like the second year, it was like, okay, now we can build. We, you know, I survived it. We showed we can do this. We can keep the ship afloat. So now let's see what else we can do. And then we started to really have fun with it and just, you know, push ourselves. We built a really amazing team here. My sous chefs are just incredible. And, you know, that led into going down the Top Chef rabbit hole.
Right. Before we talk about that, though, when you say, you know, you decided to push yourselves, right, and take it to another level. What did that look like in the dining room? Like, what did you do?
You know, I think it was a lot
on the menu or whatever.
I think it was a lot of things on the menu. We expanded the menu a little bit to give it a couple more offerings because we felt like we could control more things and, you know, still have that higher quality. Mm-hmm. It meant creating a couple programs here that we didn't have before, you know, teaching just some new skills to our cooks, to my sous chefs. We started a completely fatto a mano program where we, you know,
made one made by hand pasta
by the chefs every day. Mm-hmm. And that was really big. That was a really big deal. I remember the first time we did it and I presented it for the servers in our menu change meeting. And I was like, yeah, we're going to do this. It'd be made by hand by either me or my sous chef, Brian, every day. We're rolling out a rolling pin. It never touches a machine. And one of my captains goes, yeah, we'll see how long that lasts. And I remember I was like, oh, fuck this guy. But in my head, I was like, yeah, we'll see how long this lasts. But, you know, 2 years later, we're still doing
it. That's amazing. That's great.
And it was, you know, that was a really big deal for us. Mm-hmm. And just doing little things to get more people involved. In the beginning, I felt like I couldn't let it go and I had to keep it really tight and it had to be mine. Yeah. And then I felt like I get to a point where it's now I could help other people create too.
Yeah.
Let my sous chefs be more involved. Let a line cook try to make a dish. And just doing little, trying to do just more thoughtful things.
Yes.
As far as for the guests too. More thoughtful things for our cooks to make sure they're learning. You know, being better mentors. That was a really big deal for us. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily things that it's like we're trying to get 2 Michelin stars, but it was like things that it's like we're trying to be a better restaurant. How do we build a better culture? Changing the way our cooks talk to each other.
Yes.
Changing the way we talked about our week. Making the cooks have meetings and talk to each other and give each other peer-to-peer feedback. Be open and honest with each other about things and have to have hard conversations with each other while still being positive about it.
Yeah.
Those were really important things for us.
Yeah.
And those were the things we've really been focusing on the last 2 years. It's like, okay, the food works, but like, let's try to totally change the culture and build the perfect culture of the restaurant we want, or at least as close as we can get to it. And let's see if we can still do that and maintain that we're a 1 Michelin star restaurant, mm-hmm. that we're, you know, a fine dining restaurant, that we're doing all these things, but let's try to do it in a very different way.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the most important thing to me, and that's been the most satisfying thing for me in the past 2 years.
That's great. 1 Michelin star is a good place to be, isn't it?
It's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful place to be.
I don't know if I should name it. There's a chef in Northern California who I know. He's had 1 Michelin star for years. And I asked him if he was trying to get up to 2. He said, as soon as you have more, you're just waiting to lose them or get the 3rd. He's like, 1 is great.
1's beautiful.
1 is great.
1's beautiful. You know what I mean? It's like.
Okay. Talk to me about Top Chef. Why did you want to do that?
You know,
to me, it's like somebody running for office. It's like, really, why do you? I understand the rewards, but it just seems like you're putting yourself through the ringer.
Oh man,
you were in Colorado, correct?
I was in Colorado.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those funny things because it's like having. You know, I worked for Art Smith, who did mm-hmm. Top Chef Masters. Mm-hmm. I worked for Steph, who she obviously won Top Chef.
Yeah.
And then you know went on to do Iron Chef Gauntlet, and won that because Steph wins. That's mm-hmm. what she does. And, you know, having worked for Tony, who also did Top Chef Masters. Yeah. But it was one of those things. Tony called me one day. And he's like, hey, you at the restaurant? And I was like, yeah. He's like, you want to talk to the people from Top Chef? And I was like, not really. He's like, well, they're on their way over there. So take a meeting. I was like, you think so? And he's like, yeah, take a meeting.
Okay.
And, you know, you don't refuse Tony. Right. And so I said, all right, I'll take a meeting. So I sit down, I talk to these people for a little while, and they're like.
This is like casting people?
Yeah. Apparently they were in Chicago. They did an open casting. Mm-hmm. They didn't like anybody, and they called Tony, and they said, hey, do you know anybody we should talk to in Chicago before
we
leave?
Right.
And he's like, yeah, I got this guy. You should come meet him.
Okay.
So they show up. They talk to me. And I'm like. And they're like, why do you want to do this? I don't know if I want to do this. I go, I took this meeting to see kind of what's up. Like, well, I'm interested. And, you know, at the end of it, she goes, you got to do it. She goes, just please keep coming down this rabbit hole with us.
Did they film you that day?
No. It's just 3 people talking at a table. She got to do this. Like, just trust me, like, come down the rabbit hole with me. She's like, it's a lot, it's a pain in the ass, but like, she's like, I think you'd be good. And I was like, I don't know. I was on the fence, so I called my wife, and she's like, you know what? Timing works. Your life works right now. If Tony is on board with you doing this, like, why don't you just see where it goes? So I started kind of going down, and you do more and more stuff, and it goes further and further, and you have to do all this crazy shit.
For the casting.
Yeah. You're sending them pictures. You're sending them videos. You're sending them, you know, I had to go do a psych test. I had to do a physical. Yeah. I had to, you know, do all these things. And then, you know, finally, 2 weeks before, I think it was April, like, 16th, they called me, and they said, hey, you be in Denver May 5th. You're on the show. So it's like a short, you know, it's a pretty short fucking porch.
Yeah.
But I think what pushed me over the edge with it, what interested me in it, was because someone who I worked for, you know, like, Steph had done it, and Steph won. And I had, like, so much respect for Steph and just everything she's done. And that was one of her adventures and one of the, you know, parts of her life. And I always was so curious about that part. And it wasn't a thing we really talked about a lot when I worked for her. You know, we didn't talk about Top Chef a lot.
I've known an unusual number of people who have won Top Chef. I just have. Some of them are good friends of mine. I've met other ones on various projects. It doesn't really come up. It seems to be a very isolated part of your life.
Yeah, it's like you talk about it with, like, other Top Chef people, but it's like...
Or some interviewer asked you about it.
Right, yeah. But it's, you know, we never really talked about it. We talked about food, restaurants, everything else. Yeah. But I had more of, like, all right, what is this really like? What if I go? Like, I never thought I would win. I was like, I'll just go. I want to see what this adventure is like. Yeah. Maybe I could, you know, I think I could slug it out, end up somewhere in the top five. But I think, you know, like, what does it really look like? How hard is it really? And I think that was the big question I was asking myself. Like, do you have the chops to really be there?
Did you watch the show before this? Were you a regular viewer?
I would, like, been in and out on seasons. I, like, in the earlier seasons, like Steph's season. Yeah. I remember when I worked at Table 52, we all watched that season. Okay. Like, we talked about it every week at work. Like, it was a really big deal. I think, like, 6 and 9, the ones with more Chicago people on it, I always tended to watch just because it's like, you know, it's your friends, you know them, you see them.
Right. Did you, in your background as a kid, have either any performance or athletic / competition experience? Like, were you on any teams?
Yeah, I mean, I played sports growing up. You know, I played football, baseball, basketball. Yeah. I was never on any very good teams.
Okay.
So I was never on, like, really big stages or anything like that. But
is competitiveness part of you, though? Like, when you go into that show, I think if you go into those shows, you have to have, whether it's that or something like Big Brother, you know, whatever it is, Survivor.
Mm-hmm.
You got to be competitive to win those things.
See, I'm competitive with myself,
mm-hmm.
but not like if you and I are playing a game of something right now, I don't need to beat you. I don't care. Like, okay. It just doesn't bother me. But I'm competitive and hard with myself of, like, can I do this better? Could I have done a better job?
So with, like, each challenge, you were just trying to do your personal best.
Right. And it's like, you know, they talk about it, like, professional golfers talk about it a lot. They talk about, like, you know, it's not about the field, it's about me.
Yeah.
If I shoot my best game, then if you beat me, then you shot a better game than me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's like,
but
if I shot my best...
But you're not going to do better because someone else is...
Right. If I don't shoot 63s, I'm not going to shoot 63s. Right. I'm going to shoot 65s because that's where I'm at.
Okay.
And that's kind of how I felt with that, was that, like, I don't know where I measure up with everyone else in this room the first day when I walk in. I have an idea of where I am as a cook, as a chef, as a creative person. But I don't really know. Like, what am I going to shoot? And so that's really the only way I thought about it. It wasn't like, I got to make a better dish than this person. It was like, I need to execute perfectly.
Yeah.
And, like, some days you didn't.
Yeah.
And that's where you really got in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of how I thought about it. I'm not like, you know, because some people are just straight up like, if we're playing tic-tac-toes, it's like, if I don't win, I'm going to throw a table through a window. You know what I mean? And it's like, I've never been like that competitive.
Got it. So you though, had a second life on that show.
I did. I got kicked off.
Yeah.
And then I went to Last Chance Kitchen, and I won that, and then went back on.
So you could, and then you got kicked, am I remember, it was a risotto?
It was, you know what, it was, man. This
am
was,
I allowed to say this?
Yeah, no.
That's
this
an
was,
Italian
it was
dish.
So, it, but it was, a risotto using cauliflower as rice instead of rice.
Okay.
And it was the problem was I made a David Kinch dish for David Kinch.
Okay.
And so it's like you can't make a chef's, and I forgot. I knew I had seen this dish somewhere, mm-hmm. and I had never made it before, and I was really, really reaching. You know, because you're under duress and you just start doing things. And then, you know, we went up to chef's tables and David Kinch is there. And, you know, the guy next to me leans over and he's like, you know, David Kinch does that at Men Racer, right? And I was like, oh, shit. And I could picture the dish perfectly in my head. You know, they cut these perfectly little fava beans. Yeah. I'm sure you've seen it. And I was like, oh. And I started laughing because I knew I was done.
Yeah.
Because it was like, you can't cook. It's like somebody coming in, you know, doing gnocchi for Tony. And it's like, that's a terrible idea.
Right.
It's not going to be his. Like, he is a very specific way he likes his dish done. So even my dish was good, not whatever. It's like, yeah, that's going to be his least favorite for sure. Right. Because it's like, I just, like, absolutely made a terrible version of, you know, a dish that he makes, you know, the most perfect version of.
Right.
Every day at his restaurant. So funny.
But then they had this thing, Last Chance Kitchen. So that was like, you could get back, it was a, you could get back into the the game.
Yeah, so you could battle it out, and then one person gets back in. So I ran the gauntlet on that, got back in. I made a redemption risotto on that. Worked out quite nicely. And then got back into the competition, and it was like, you know, it was like one of those things where it was just like I had a second chance, so I was just having fun with it. Mm-hmm. And I think that was really my advantage coming back in. It was just like totally loosened me up. Yeah. You know, your worst fear on the whole thing, you're like, oh, my God, what if I get cut? What if I go home? Well, once that happens, it's like, what else you got to worry about?
Right.
You just go and cook and like try to have fun with it because it's like really cool. You know what I mean? You're on top of a mountain. You're in Colorado. You're going to these crazy places you never get to go. But it's hard to see it sometimes because you're so stressed and you're so concerned and you're so just like overwhelmed because, you know, it's hard.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, you try to just like tell yourself like, hey, this is awesome. Like, appreciate the moment.
Yeah.
Like, this is really cool. Yeah. This is a once-in-a-lifetime experience, you know? Like, nobody gets this.
Right.
Like, this is, you know, it was like, that was the hard stuff to remind yourself while you're there.
Did you learn anything about yourself doing that show?
You know, I felt like as a chef, you know, it's a huge lesson in conciseness. And, you know, the one thing, I think, the undervalued thing of that show, which I think is really cool, is as, you know, we're chefs, we get to create. You get to put your dishes up in front of some of the best chefs, the best people in your field. So whatever your craft is, you get to do your craft for, you know, the people you've always wanted to cook for or cook with.
Yeah.
And get real feedback about it.
Who meant a lot to you?
You know what was amazing? And it's like they don't really show it enough, but like Tom is like, when he explains stuff, like if something he doesn't like of yours, it's like really thoughtful.
Yeah.
And it's like, he's like, oh no. Like
he's quietly brilliant.
And it's like, you know, a 30-minute explanation that's, you know, cut to 1 minute on the show where he looks like he's being an asshole to you, where he's like, this is why you should have done that and this is Have you tried this? Like, this is how this works. And you're like, that's a really good point. Like, you know, he's like, well, why didn't you do this? It's like, I didn't think of that, Tom. You know, and it was like, that was a lot of it sometimes. And he'd like laugh. And he'd like, cool. He's like, I get it. Yeah. He's like, totally. But I thought he was really cool. I mean, cooking from Daniel Ballude was like,
yeah.
I mean, that was rocking. And he really, and that was, you know, a challenge I won. And he really liked my dish. And that was like, whoa.
Yeah.
You know, when you get to cook for someone, and it's like, we cook for people every day and get to make people happy. But, you know, if you cook for someone like Ballude, like, not gonna like trick him. It's not gonna be like, oh well, it was kind of seasoned, so I'm okay with that.
Right.
You know, and it's like, so it's when you cook for someone like that, and you get to get real feedback and be like, you know, this is what I like, this is what I didn't like. Like, it just makes you better.
Yeah.
It's like a honing process. Yes. It's just like
totally get it.
It hurts when you hit the steel, but you need it.
Yes.
You know, and it's and I thought that was a really great learning process for me in the show, and just focusing in and being like, so what are the, you know, I spent all this time cooking food for other people, for other chefs in their restaurants, and it's like, so what does the food I'm making now say about me? Like, you know, what does it show? How does it explain my journey? And I felt like those were really good lessons.
That's great. You know, it's funny, Richard Blaze was on this podcast, and he sort of himself was a second chance story. He didn't win originally, but he won the All-Stars.
Yeah.
And we were talking, and I said, you know, of all these competition shows,
I said, I feel like real chefs win Top Chef. And he said, Andrew, it's not just that. He said the top four or five on that show are all really good cooks. Like, a good half of the field are really good. Like, they pick really good people. And then so the person who wins it is really good.
Yeah.
You know?
And but I think...
It is interesting.
I think, you know, one of the things about that show, too, is, like, a lot of people, it's like, they might be a really good chef just, like, in their specific thing that they do, too.
Right.
Like, if you went to the restaurant, it might be awesome, but it's like, also, it's like, if you're in Colorado and you can't get, you know, guajillo peppers, like, you're probably not going to be able to cook your food, and then you need some versatility to be able to do different things. But it's like, it doesn't mean they're a bad chef. It just means that they're just, you know, they might not have the breadth of experience of some other people.
Sure.
So, and I think that's a big part of it, too.
Yeah.
It's like...
Great. If it's not too personal, you're about 2 months from fatherhood?
Yeah. Yeah.
How does that, I don't want to get too personal, but in terms of, you got a big job here.
Yes.
How do you think about that change in your life?
You know, Tony was joking with me. He goes, since you won the show, he's like, I think I've had the conversation with you. He goes, about three times where it's ended in, this is going to completely change your life. He goes, but this is the biggest. He goes, this is going to completely change your life. But, you know, to have somebody like him as a mentor who, you know, Tony's a mentor to me in so many more ways than, you know, the kitchen of it is really the most minimal part. It just like, you know, he's a guy who he's still married after 34 years.
Mm-hmm.
He has a son who he has a phenomenal relationship with. Mm-hmm. Like, that is not common in this industry, you know, and I feel like that is really hard. And like seeing someone do that and seeing someone push you to say, hey, do it. Don't be scared. Take the jump. Like, it's worth it. It's worth the risk. That means a lot. And, you know, it'll change my life for sure. And I think all for the better. And it's, I think, you know, as chefs, one of the hardest things to learn is balance.
Yeah.
And I think that's derails a lot of chefs, a lot of people in, you know, any field. But I think that'll be the great challenge with it. But I think it's also the great excitement of it. Of, you know, what does my life look like now? You know, and it's cool. And, you know, I have a lot of friends who are chefs who are my age or a little bit older around, or we're, a few of us are having kids right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exciting. It's just like, what does that become? You know, what is this kid's relationship with this restaurant?
And you also have a little kind of unofficial support group.
Right. And it's, you know, but, you know, the other thing is we're very fortunate. You know, I'm from here. My wife's from here. My parents are both from here. My grandparents are, you know, my family's lived on the south side of Chicago for three generations.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we just moved back down there. We got people there. You know, we have a support system, so we are extremely, extremely lucky and fortunate to have that.
You are. You know. We have twins. We had no family in New York, and it was brutal.
That's, you know, what everyone's told me. And we decided, you know, we moved back to the south side and bought a house, and we're like, you know, we need to circle the wagons and be with the family. And that was a really important and a really big choice from me and my wife. And, you know, and we'll figure it out from there. Luckily, you know, I'm married to an amazing person who's an incredible partner. And, you know, we'll figure it out. But it's, I think, the most exciting thing to me, like the one thing that's like geeking me out about this. I mean, there's a million things, but it's like, I'm so excited to, like, you know, we're having a boy. The idea of, like, I get to introduce, like, this person to, like, a whole world of food.
Mm.
Like, all their first experiences, you know. It's just, like, things that, you know, I didn't see till I was in my 20s, in my early 30s, whatever. But it's just, like, you know, that'll be so cool to show a kid that. You know, to be able to, like, take, you know, my son to, like, the Korean market and be like, come on, we're going to go, like, buy a bunch of kimchi and get some kalbi and, you know, eat GJ or, you know, go to little Italian spots or be able to, you know, travel with them and show them places that, you know, I've been. And that, to me, is really, really exciting. And I think taking, you know, the things I've been fortunate enough to gain from this industry and from my career and from my work and being able to, you know, that I've been able to share that with my wife, and now that I'll be able to get to share it with someone else, just feels like... It's so overwhelming with, like, gratefulness and just amazement.
That's great. You're in for a treat on that front. It's the best. Okay. Great meeting you. Thank you again for everything with the dinner yesterday. And we'll see you again soon.
Thank you. All right. Pleasure to be on.
Thanks.
And that's our show for this week. And Caitlin, you know, I didn't even say this at the beginning of the show. Last week, I was about to get on a plane.
Mm-hmm.
You are about to really get on a plane.
Many planes.
You're about to get on a succession of planes over several days. You are going to Europe for your job.
I am.
Where are you going?
Frankfurt.
Yeah.
Then Paris.
Yeah.
Then Cannes.
Crazy.
And then Nice. And then home.
Oh, my God.
I know. I'm really excited.
I know.
It's a ton of work, but I'm really excited
it's
about
great.
It.
It's great. Well, bon voyage. I want to thank Joe Flam for being our guest this week. Thank you, Chef. I know how busy you are there. Caitlin, thank you. Safe travels.
Thank you, Andrew.
Have fun.
Thank you. I will.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Vitor, our engineer. Thank you, sir, for editing this show. And to all of you out there in podcast land, thank you for listening. I have to say, this is a transitional time at the network. Kat Johnson, who's been sort of my contact at the network and sort of a facilitator of the transition, is away this week. We have a new engineer, Vitor, as we've said. I do have a backlog of episodes. We're going to record one more intro right now, Caitlin. I don't know when it will air. It will depend on the workload at Heritage and how quickly they're able to, you know, edit it and get it up. But hopefully you'll hear that soon. So until next week, hopefully if not sooner, we'll see you back here soon on Andrew Talks to Chefs. Just